just individuals that were in jail that I felt like if they had had the right support, I felt like they could be where they need to be instead of being in jail, because I felt like it didn't serve any purpose for them.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day. Lord, we thank you just for each and every person that's in this building. We thank you for our guests speaking tonight. We thank you for each and every one that took out the time to be able to deposit into this program, to be able to uplift us and encourage us. Heavenly Father, I thank you just for all the things that you do. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Ooh, welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show.
Yay.
Yeah.
Okay, people, so let's cook.
Let's cook.
Let's cook.
What are you cooking?
Well, joining us in the studio today, we have the lovely Latasma McGee.
Hi.
A Georgian native, a mother of two, and a counselor to many. With a master's degree in clinical rehabilitation counseling from Mercer University, she's joining us tonight to talk about the correlation between addiction and mental health.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us tonight.
So glad to be here. This is, I feel like it's a great opportunity for me to be able to just provide some awareness and kind of shed some light as far as like the correlation, because because of the stigma that society has placed on mental health, a lot of times it get placed behind. And I feel like that's most of the underlying concerns when it comes to addiction.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, like who you are, how you got started in your field?
Well, I graduated from Fort Valley State University with my undergrad of psychology, bachelor's in psychology. Worked in the school system for a couple of years. Decided I wanted to go back to school because I wanted to become licensed.
No.
Yes. Okay. So I did my first master's with University of Phoenix in psychology. But it wasn't until I got ready to apply for my licensure that the state of Georgia said that I did not do a clinical program. So guess what? I ended up going back to school. But it wasn't until years later. So I graduated with my first master's in like 2008. And I decided to go back to school in 2022.
Amen.
So I love that you have to specify your first master's. Like, let's not just gloss over that.
The first one.
So you have an undergraduate degree and then two master's degrees.
I do.
That's
yes.
incredible.
Yes.
That's incredible. So with you, when you got your first master's, what were you doing with that? What did that open doors for?
So I had the privilege of working. As soon as I graduated, I had an opportunity to work into community-based counseling therapeutic services. And with that, I was in a home. We had individuals that were clients of defects cases, individuals that had just mental health disorders like substance abuse, schizophrenia, and then they were dually diagnosed with substance use. Just from the severe diagnosis to mild. So anxiety, depression, and bipolar schizophrenia. So just an array of mental health disorders. And so a lot of them were dually diagnosed, as I previously mentioned. So at that time, because I was unlicensed, and I still am unlicensed, I'm working towards licensure now. But at that time, when we were doing community-based services, I had to do skill training. So pretty much I did more like almost like a paraprofessional. From a paraprofessional standpoint, I did like skill training, parenting skills for coping strategies and things like that. So those are the type of services that I provided. And then I also was an intake assessor, so I went in doing the intakes. Or individuals or new clients and things like that. So I did all that in the community.
You better eat, girl.
Yeah.
You better do it.
And so I have a lot of experience in the field post my first master's, because I've worked in crisis. And like I say, in a housing program, permanent supportive housing program, currently in an outpatient program. And so I just have an array of, I'm just blessed to have an array of experience to kind of align with my vision that I have for my future.
Okay. And with all of that experience that you have, is working in addiction something like specific that you do now?
It is something that I do now. I'm a PRN therapist, and what I do now, I do group counseling. And so I have group individuals with either dually diagnosed and or mental health or just substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. And so I provide group work activities and things like that. We do process group, psychoeducational group, anything that I feel like would be beneficial for them as they are on their journey to the next level.
And was there something that, like, was there like an experience that you had that really put addiction as like the modality you really wanted to lean in, as opposed to just the mental health or just the community services, but specifically addiction? Did something happen?
Well, most of the individuals that I work with in the past, addiction has always been in the forefront with the mental health. The unfortunate side is that most individuals that are diagnosed, I mean, that have identified that they have a problem with substance use, the mental health is underlying. I mean, they is never identified. I mean, haven't been identified until they start the process of treatment because of unawareness.
And do you have a lot of experience seeing people who are maybe like overdiagnosed, overprescribed, underprescribed, underdiagnosed? Because I've like, when it comes to specifically like that topic of addiction recovery and mental health, it's like a complete split. Like, people have polarizing opinions where it's like, oh, well, if you deal with addiction, like, of course you're going to have some underlying mental health issues. But then there's other people who are like, oh, you're in addiction recovery, of course you think you have underlying mental health issues. It's like, what if you just put the substances down, if you just put the bottle down, then all of your problems will go away? Where some people truly do have that experience,
right,
and some people truly do not have that experience. So is that something you've had to see a lot and advocate for?
I have had to advocate for a lot of individuals. Working in a correctional setting, I noticed that a lot of individuals that were coming in with mental health, mental health symptoms, but just unaware. And with their history, their background, of course, was substance use as well. They were either homeless or just had very limited support. And so as a mental health case manager and a mental health counselor, I had the privilege of working with these individuals, providing resources, community resources, because, like I said, a lot of them were homeless. A lot of them were in jail because they were trespassing. They didn't have anywhere to go. Mm-hmm. Most of them were trespassing. They were homeless because of their addiction history. And so with that, like I said, most of them, they were already diagnosed with a mental health disorder, but because they were homeless, unable to get the transportation they needed to make it to and from their mental health appointments, they chose to use, you know, substance. And like I said, that became the thing that they leaned on until they became incarcerated. So, like I said, it appears to be an ongoing cycle. And the more and more that I work with individuals with the substance use history or substance use disorder, I find that a lot of them have had either experienced some type of crisis, some type of trauma. Maybe in their early years as a child, they were diagnosed with a mental health disorder. They start with ADHD in most cases, because you can't be really diagnosed with a mental health disorder until you become of age, to a certain age. Mm-hmm. So in the early years.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not until maybe you reach possibly middle school age, really? When they start to branch off and say, okay, maybe depression, generalized anxiety disorder, depending upon if there's an ongoing history of behavior that you've experienced in school. with the ADHD. If the medication is not working, and like I said, your behavior, you know, it just all depends on your behavior, and how it transitions to your mood and things like that. And so that's how they start to branch off into the elevated diagnosis, so, to the next level.
Let me ask you this. You said after a certain age, then you get diagnosed with mental illness. Mm-hmm. So what are they diagnosing it as when you're younger? What are we calling it?
It's ADHD.
That's just it.
It's ADHD, conduct disorder, intermittent explosive disorder.
Oh, man.
So it's those orders, disorders like that, diagnosis like that, that kind of pretty much, it kind of shed light on basically like your baseline as a child.
Okay.
So it's pretty much addressing, you know, we're trying to address those issues and concerns that they're dealing with now. Mm-hmm. And so, say for instance, if I have a client, because I do school-based therapy. I have a client that's experiencing these disruptive behaviors and things like that. Okay, I said, I may recommend to the family, hey, I think that a psychological is needed. And so once the psychotherapy is not working, you know, especially, you know, like we, you know, try out different levels, like just one time weekly, then we go to a more intense level. And then we feel like if that's not working, then we may like recommend they see their primary care physician for like medication, like and they prescribe like a medication for ADHD to kind of manage your behavior at that age,
right,
because they don't see a psychologist or a psychiatrist at that time.
Wow.
And so you say you work in the schools currently?
I work, so the agency that I work for, we provide school-based therapy to individuals of all ages from pre-K to 12th grade.
Oh, wow. That's like a wide range of...
It is. And I have clients in elementary school, middle school, and high school. And so I feel like it is important that a lot of our kids are receiving these services in the school. I feel like the school system really, they kind of only scratch the surfaces along with other entities in our community as far as like providing mental health, the services that are needed, because most individuals that are in school, they have these experience these behavior problems and things like that. And like I said, depending upon their community, their awareness, their family's awareness of mental health, they don't know what's going on with them. Mm-hmm. And so it's those behaviors, they're exhibited in their behavior at school. And so that's where like the conduct disorders and things like that, they acting out at school because they're experiencing some things at home. And so I feel like I did research, like a research paper on this for school, their early intervention for behavioral health and mental health in the school system will definitely shed light for a lot of individuals instead of them waiting till they get up until their teen years and adult years, and not knowing that they have a mental health diagnosis.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can catch it early.
And what does that early intervention look like? Like, is it, you know, getting DFACs involved, or is it, you know, get like you directly talking with the parents, or the guidance counselors talking with the parents? Like, what does that intervention look like?
The early intervention, it puts the teachers, the school administrators, the parents, and the psychology department, everybody on the same page when it comes to providing these services for our kids in the school system. And like I said, you know, I feel like the school system is the best way to do it because of a lot of families, they don't have insurance. They lack insurance. And now it's hard to get mental health treatment with insurance. And so just think of without any type of insurance, if you don't have any income, anything like that, that, you know, I see that is happening as a pattern. And it's kind of hard, like I said, to get the services that you need without any financial support or insurance.
Yeah, I've definitely seen a couple of friends go through that struggle where, you know, like they wait tables, but they have kids and their kids, you know, have things that they need help with and that they don't have insurance, or the insurance they do have doesn't include that kind of coverage. And then you have to pay out of pocket, and it can just become, you know, really expensive really quickly.
Yes.
And so are there currently community resources that people may not know about?
Well, that's what I'm currently working on now. I used to have a binder where I collected resources, but I'm in the process of rebuilding that. So the resources post-COVID, a lot of resources went away.
Right.
I'm just going to be transparent. And so it's kind of hard. But I think reaching out to the counselors, they usually have the contact for us, like providing the school-based therapy and, you know, like early intervention like that in the school system. And then you can also check, always check with your local community service board for outpatient services, because most of them, they do what is called value options. So in most cases, there are a lot of situations where they provide services for individuals that don't have any insurance or don't have any income.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they base it on a sliding scale fee, where you can receive services based off of your income that you do receive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The outpatient program I went through was county funded. It was not good, but it was there. And they, you know, I had a social worker. Like, it was really weird, like, looking at my chart. And they're like, at risk for homelessness. I'm like, you know, but they really saved my life, you know, and I don't know how I got connected with it or or anything, but it really, like, it, that was the one connection. And then from there, they're like, okay, you need to get a new glasses prescription. Here's a place that'll help you. Mm-hmm. You need to see a therapist. Here's a referral to this apartment. You need, like, all these things. Like, it really helped navigate, like, those early days of recovery. And you know, being fresh off the street, not having insurance, not, you know, having any finances to fall back on.
So definitely you can always, you know, lean on your community, like as a community outpatient. And then at least they kind of shed some light, you know, to kind of put you in a position, you know, where you can kind of identify, you know, what is going on with you. And then possibly be exposed to other resources that are out there. But at least that's a starting point. I always say create a starting point. So I think that's very important.
Yeah. So, Ms. Latazwa.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Looking good.
Well, thank you.
So, please tell us how, tell the audience and the viewers, how did we meet?
Well, it was a long I met Mr. Jason at Riverwoods outpatient program. He was a step down from Riverwoods Behavioral Health. And I met him, like I said, on the outpatient side in my groups. So, you know, of course, we passed by a couple of times, and it wasn't until our encounter. Well, once we had that first encounter, like we had that conversation. Oh,
do you remember the conversation we had? I don't even remember. In the office, and I would always, because she's so cute.
Thank you. She's adorable. Thank you.
And so I remember I went to the first group. We had different groups you would go to, because we had, it was what, one, two, maybe I think five therapists, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so Latazma, her groups, they hit different. So you, when you go in her group, it wasn't so stuffy like the normal, just, oh, I'm in therapy, and I'm in, I like, padded walls type time. You know, you didn't feel like that. She's always been transparent since the day we met. I can tell you how we started. It was the popcorn.
Oh, yeah.
So let me tell you about this, too. We still beefing behind the popcorn thing.
Oh, no.
So she has a side business that she does. And it's like
the gourmet popcorn.
It's the gourmet popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted some of the popcorn. So I would ask for this popcorn all the time, and she would always chunk me off all the time.
But what did I say? What was my reasoning for not providing the popcorn for you?
Well, she busy, but I'm spoiled. And I wanted her to make me spoiled. I wanted popcorn.
Yeah, that's how our conversations went.
That's how the whole thing started. The whole relationship started from that, because I went from being in her group to doing privates with her. Now, during the privates, I really appreciate how you, she reeled me in privates in a different type of way, where, because I was real resistant to it.
Because
my mom had just died, and I was struggling with that, being homeless, struggling with that. And so we started doing privates, and she was giving me assignments Mm-hmm. Homework.
Yes.
You see, homework.
Look, a therapist who gives homework is a good therapist.
Yes, yeah. She does. Yeah. Trust me. Mm-hmm. And so we had homework. But what really allowed me to know, she did this thing one day. So we had a session on that Saturday. And she's after the session, she said, so I want to make sure that we close this. I didn't really get what she was saying until later on that day. So she comes up to me later on the afternoon and she's like, are you okay? I want to make sure that we close that session. Because she explained to me that when you're in therapy and you go through the process of therapy with your therapist, that you take those emotions and feelings with you outside that room. But so she made sure she came to me and closed the session with me so I wouldn't carry on with that whole thing that entire day. And it had never happened to me in therapy. I had been going to different therapists way before I started doing privates with her. And so I was like, this lady really know what she's talking about.
Yeah, because there's, like, I've been in and out of therapy for a very long time. And I've had therapists who are like, wow, that was a rough one. Good luck with the rest of your day.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, the game changed when I was with my first therapist who was like, okay, like, she's like, that was a lot. Mm-hmm. She's like, let's ground.
Yeah.
She's like, and whatever you're doing for the rest of the day, no, you're not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's like, you're taking care of yourself. You're taking care of, like, you're doing a bath. You're doing self-care, you know. Or she would kick me out of my house and be like, you're not going to be alone for the rest of the day, you know.
Right,
and,
right.
like, that was the game changer of someone being like, this is raw. This is open. Mm-hmm. But let's still take care of you in the present moment.
Exactly. Yes.
We had the relationship that we built. We built a therapist and client first, and then it grew into a friendship. Now, what I respect about the friendship is that she knows how to separate the two completely. She knows how to, when it's time for her to therapize me, she knows how to do that. And when it's time to be a friend to me, she also knows how to do that. So I'm in those spaces in my life where it's this thing where I think people like to 12-step you. I know you'll get what I'm saying. It's like, just because you have these credentials, why can't we just have a regular conversation? Mm-hmm. Why in the hell every time you turn around, that if I'm just asking you about, did you get the new hamburger at Burger King? You're like, well, you know that you need to process. Look, cool. Let's just talk like regular people. Mm-hmm. I don't want that. And Latasha has the ability to know how to separate the two. And the respect I have for her allows me to know how to separate the two as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I never mix it together because she's taught me a lot. She's taught me how to always prepare and have a plan. When we met, she played a very pivotal part in my growth at Riverwoods. When I was at Riverwoods, when I came in Riverwoods, I was homeless without a birth certificate, without an ID or a license, without a social security card. This young lady was with me through these steps. Where even if it had to be times that she would go into her own purse and pay for something for me or give me a ride in her car from Riverwoods that was in Riverdale all the way to Griffin to get my birth certificate. So the relationship, it's not just that she's a therapist. She's like a hero to me.
I don't know about all that.
Yeah, she is to me. Because I look back on a lot of things that happened and she is there. Like when I just look back on a lot of those situations, you know it too. Like, she was really there. And then it was times when she was a therapist. It was times she was a friend. And then she was just a good-hearted human being. Mm. And she would just do it for me. She would do it for anybody who needed help too. Of course, I was her favorite already. You know that. but she did. And I never got the popcorn. Never. That never happened.
You know what?
And you walked in here empty-handed tonight.
I know, right? Still to this day, well, we have not.
Let's do the backstory for the popcorn. First of all,
let me get this stuff out of the way.
Okay, so when I birthed my baby, my popcorn business is Popcorn Junkie.
Mm-hmm. That's the
name. J-U-N-K-E-E.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love it already.
Yes.
Ironically.
Gourmet popcorn. My second year of my baby, I decided to go back to school. And so as I started my journey back to school, I also had a daughter that was starting college as well at that time. So we started school together. And so he knows that my plate, it just became like full because I was working full time. First of all, I'm a full time mom. Then I'm a full time student. And then I'm working full time.
I still want popcorn.
Don't be so selfish.
I know. Don't be so so selfish,
Jason. I've been trying to get popcorn for 2 years.
Yes, but I'm now
2 years.
I'm now trying to switch gears now so that I can get back, because I had to put my popcorn business, even though I had poured into it, I had to put it on the back burner because I had to do what was important. And so, of course, I did big orders for work and things like that, but I had to pour my time into my program because it required a lot of me. Like I said, in my program, my clinical rehab program for Mercer. So it's like, you know, they don't play. Yeah. So I had to be in the books. So.
And so with that clinical program that you went through, mm-hmm. since then, like, is that when you started working with corrections and those doors started opening?
Actually, I was working with corrections before. I was working at, I was a mental health case manager and discharge planner at Clayton County Jail. So that's where I got my start in the corrections. And then as I was working there, that's when I decided I wanted to go back to school. Because when I was calling, I thought maybe I just wanted to go for clinical mental health. But then as I was talking to the representative, he was like, well, you're working in a jail setting now, right? I was like, yes. And I was telling him about the population that I work with. He said, hey, our clinical rehab counseling program is perfect for you because the rehab, it covers, it, you know, it focuses on addiction, individuals with disabilities, individuals in the correction setting, and veterans that are returning back to civilian life, or veterans that were injured in war, and they're needing to needing counseling, or just like I say, trying to find start their transition into the work field.
So it sounds like you have like a. You're well versed in reintegration and transitions, because if you have, you know, people in corrections, mm-hmm. people in addiction recovery, people who are disabled, veterans returning, like that's a whole lot of different types of transitions and reentry.
She's therapizing me and popping popcorn.
I do my best.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to be in your waiting room, gourmet popcorn.
Right, have some gourmet popcorn popping and everything.
If I ever get it.
And so how did working in corrections kind of change your perspective of what care should look like?
Seeing individuals that were in these cells with these mental health diagnoses, you know, disorders, they don't have any support. Right. Their cases, like I say, this is post-COVID now. I started working in December 2021. So post-COVID, you got cases. You know how everything was put, you know, backlog for, mm-hmm. Everything. And so just individuals that were in jail that I felt like if they had had the right support, I felt like they could be where they need to be instead of being in jail, because I felt like it didn't serve any purpose for them. You know, especially like I say, they're trespassing because they're homeless, basically trying to survive. Mm-hmm. You know, out here trying to survive, mm-hmm. and you know, you get locked up for trespassing, or you know, just like in an abandoned house. You know, like I said, they considered trespassing. It's mm-hmm. like it just was unfortunate for me, mm-hmm. And I felt like I was like, man, because when I said I was a discharge planner, I was a discharge planner for the entire jail. So anybody that was going home, I was going out to the different units. And so anybody that was going home, I provided resources to those individuals. During my time there at Clayton County Jail, working with a couple of the public defenders, I was able to form a collaborative program with Clayton Center counseling program. With the with the public defenders, and so to kind of help these individuals, house these individuals, so the ones that are getting ready to be released, so they have somewhere to go. They also have the services that they need, so that, you know, it kind of minimizes their options for the jail being a revolving door for them.
Yeah. And so did that kind of, so you went from you were in schools and then you were in corrections and then you went back to schools?
No, I'm currently in the schools now. Okay. And so I started, so my, I was in the community. I started out in the community.
The community.
Yes.
Right,
I worked in the community and then I transitioned to a community service board. I worked there for like, well, actually, you know, let me go back. I was started in the community and then I felt like, I got tired of basically pounding the pavement. And when I say that, it's like I was going everywhere, driving everywhere, going into homes, and I want to be closer to home. So I applied for a paraprofessional position with the school system. And so I was a paraprofessional for individuals with behavioral. So early the EIB class, right. I was a parapro for that. And then from there, I went to a community service board where I worked for 4 years. I started out as an intake assessor. So everybody that came through that were in crisis, 10, 13, whatever the case may be, I did start the assessment process that way. I transitioned to a case manager, transitioned to the discharge lead, transitioned to the permanent support of housing, transitioned to the corrections. But you know what? I'm so thankful for my experience because it has led me. It allows me to be able to pour into my individuals as much as I need to. I love what I do. I love doing group. Like, if I could do group all day, every day, I love it. Because I like to meet them where they are. Yeah. I don't consider myself as up here. And they're, you know, like, they're the clients and me. We're all on the same level. Because I tell everyone, we're one crisis away from being in the same situation. Yeah. One trauma away. And so I definitely treat them with the utmost respect. Yes. And also I just pride myself into pouring into them as much as I can.
Yes. And to pretty much just piggyback off what she said, when she says that she meets us where we're at, I can remember times that we were in group. And if you were in a space like we were, because I came from being 1013 to PHP IOP and stepping down to that. So that's how we met. So you in a space where you have someone that is a teacher, but also a therapist all in one. But you want to be able to connect to them. But a lot of the situations that we were in is, and I'm not going to speak any names per se, but the therapists were treating you like junkies. Mm-hmm. Just real talk. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm always give it to you and keep it a book. It was spaces and times and places where they were talking at me instead of teaching me and talking to me. Mm-hmm, they would junkie me and they would try to always keep a lid on my growth. It was like, he shouldn't know this or he shouldn't be well-versed in this. But Latazma, when she says she meets you where you at, she treats you like a human.
She treats you like a human.
Now, she never struggled with drugs or anything like that, but she still understands that people are people. And so when we would do groups and group there, I stopped going to all of them. Like, real talk, we would have a choice to pick the therapist that if she worked, because she was through PRN, so she worked part time. The days
Fridays
that
and
Fridays and Saturday,
you were in group.
I didn't care what the heck going on because I knew, you know where you get your love from.
Yeah,
I don't care who you are. I don't care what state you're in. You know who love you. You know who's gonna be there for you. And she would. She encouraged me to the resource books that we were talking about. I built two resource books, mm-hmm. two huge resource books, and it had a lot to do with her because she also taught me the things that she knew. She taught it to me. She wasn't looking at me like a junkie that used to smoke crack and say, okay, this is somebody who is just unattainable and I can't do anything with and I can't help encourage and deposit into this person. She saw me. Mm-hmm. And when she saw me, she put it in me. This is now, I left that place back in when?
January.
Mm-hmm. We still have a relationship to this day. Mm-hmm. Her invested into my life. Look where it has gotten me now.
Yes, I'm so happy for him.
Look where it's gotten me now. And I thank God for it too. And then we didn't mention this too. Let me also say this, because this is most braggadocious worthy. She has a beautiful relationship with the Lord.
Yes.
Beautiful relationship with God. Mm-hmm. You can't be this and do what she does without having God in your life. This is just my opinion, and I go by what I see. She talks what she walks.
I try.
She's authentic with everyone. She's transparent with only a few, because she won't take her personal life is something that she doesn't hide, but she doesn't share it. Because I learned some things also about Latazma that during the times that she was, and I'm not going to put your personal business out there. You know I'm not going to go there. It'll be up to you.
Yeah.
But I learned that she was facing her own trials and tribulations throughout the process that she was encouraging and uplifting me. And so we would talk and I'd be like, man, really? You come to work after dealing with this situation and putting up with this and having to go through this, and she comes to work and you would never know. Mm. You would never know. And it's in situations that I know I would just threw the towel in as far as dealing with other people and knowing that I have to come here. And then there was a crowd too, like the group that we had.
Yeah.
But I think that's just, you know, evident that, you know, you really are passionate about what you do and love what you do.
Yes.
You've mentioned a lot about the stigma and you've mentioned about, you know, addiction and mental health going hand in hand. And then you've been in corrections. So if you want to look at that, like post-crisis, now you're in corrections. Mm-hmm. And then pre-crisis, now you're in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you feel like you are more in the position now to assist with that intervention before someone gets to a crisis point, like you mentioned?
Yes, that's why I want to start my start a consultant agency. I already have the name for it. It's been something that I've had for a long time in dealing with some of the experience I had to go through with my own daughter, being, you know, just an ordeal, not nothing as much as what she did, but just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so what I want to do with my consulting agency is I want to be able to provide awareness to my community about mental health, about addiction, family, intervention, outreach. So that's why I want to do consulting. Not talking about corrections, but they're only limited to what they can do as far as like the Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, only on the surface level, you know. But I think the more they become aware of how mental health plays a big role for individuals that are incarcerated. Because I also worked at a correctional facility. Once I left Clayton County Jail, I went to Burris in Forsyth. So I was a mental health counselor there. So I had youthful offenders and adult offenders. Mm-hmm. And so those were my babies. So it's like I definitely saw the effects of untreated mental health when it came to those youthful offenders being sentenced, you know, their charges. A lot of them, like I said, they wasn't even aware that they had something going on, or like I said, just they have the necessary support or funds that they needed to get the help that they needed. So, and it, like I said, at that time I was already in school, but it just, I hated to leave, but I had to meet the obligations of my clinical program. Mm-hmm. So in order for me to do that, I had to stop working full time and start working PRN. Mm-hmm. So that I could finish my program. So I just recently graduated. I graduated in May 2025 and finished my clinicals first week in August. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so now I just started back studying for my my licensure, my NCE exam. So I have that coming up. And so once I get that, like I say, I'm well on my way. We're earning my clinical hours and becoming licensed. And then once I become establishing that, then I'm going to go back and get my certified rehabilitation counseling.
You're just addicted to school.
No, it's a part of my program. So it's a dual program. So it's a clinical program that allows you to become a licensed professional counselor as well as a certified rehabilitation counselor. So that's the privilege of the program. So, and that's why I was longer.
Sounds like she's going to build a one-stop shop.
Yeah, that's my goal.
With that consulting agency, like, what is your vision for that? Like, what goal are you hoping to achieve?
I want to be basically a one-stop shop. I want to be a place where I have resources available for those who need resources when it comes to housing, when it comes to addiction, and like I say, awareness. Yeah. I'm big on awareness because I feel like when you know better, you do better.
Right.
You know, even if you can't get it right the first time, you still have gained something from the things that you learned, you know, the first time off. So just, like I said, spreading awareness and whatever support I feel like is needed. And like I said, with the awareness in the community, because like I say, you still in 2025, the community is still not fully aware of the correlation with mental health and addiction.
It's still heavily stigmatized. Yeah.
Yes.
And you put the two and two together.
Yeah.
And they go together.
Yeah.
They do. Yeah. Because like I said, you know, you think about it. If you think about your history and the things that you went through as a child and how those things that you experienced as a child
it's
baggage that you will carry. I call it, I say unpack your suitcase because in most cases, I mean, you have to unpack your suitcase. It's like you have to, like you're going on vacation, you got to open that suitcase and go all the way to the bottom of that suitcase until you can get to the root of that problem.
Because it's not going nowhere.
That's where your healing begins. Once you find your healing, guess what? That's where you can start your journey to maintaining sobriety because you won't no longer be dependent on substance or alcohol, or substance, but you will you'll learn self-worth and how to value yourself, how to love yourself, how to be compassionate for yourself, because in most cases we don't give ourselves grace. You know, we're so hard on ourselves and just depending upon what mental state you're in, we like to take the easy way out, you know, and that's what I share with the individuals is that change is hard, but change is good. It can be good, and change is inevitable. So it's up to you the type of change that you want to make. And like I said, just that process of healing when it comes to your mental health, making sure that you provide that same need and support for your mental health as you do for your physical health. Just like you get up and brush your teeth, wash your face, put on clean clothes, wash your clothes, your mental health requires that same love and compassion.
And in my case, my mental health is directly related to those exact actions.
Yeah,
because whenever those things stop, it's like, hey.
Did you notice how in the she completely started doing therapy, Janine? Did you see it? I love
that. That's why you say to my, that you scoping now. You're therapizing.
I love it. Because she'll give this momentum. Because we're talking about her, of course. But then she completely forgets about herself. And then she is a whole therapy lesson. And it's a healthy, progressive therapy lesson. Like when you were doing it, it just reminds me of. It just reminds me of so many like great therapy sessions that we had that helped heal me. It really did.
Yeah.
Well, you forgot something.
What?
You did not give us the title of the place you want to name your one-stop shop.
I didn't want to.
No, we got to speak this.
Oh, we don't have to do that.
Yes, okay, we do. Can. Yes, we do.
That means I need to go ahead and get it viral because somebody's going to be a fighting chance.
Amen. Oh, I love that.
A fighting chance.
I love it. Let me ask you this. Will you be selling popcorn?
No, it's in the lobby.
It's going to be in the lobby. It's going to be complimentary popcorn
free.
For my clients.
So they get
insurance and for the pen.
They get it free.
It's going to be complimentary.
They get it free.
Yeah, they're going to get it free. Yeah. But I'm actually getting ready to start back with my popcorn because I really.
I'm going
to
get off your back about
it. Yeah.
So,
Because the flavors I did. Cookies and cream, strawberry crunch, caramel.
See, listen.
Add a flavor, please.
Listen. But yes, of course, I'm extremely proud of you for filling in the gaps. Because a lot of times, people just kind of comb over what needs to be looked at and viewed, and somebody should say, listen, we need to pay attention to this. And then God has blessed you so much and stretched you so thin to the point where you're able to go from kindergarten kids all the way to adults. I'm 44.
And you know, my prayer that I pray is for the Lord to use me as a vessel.
And he does.
To use me to be a person of service to somebody else. Yeah. So that's what I...
He does.
Yeah.
He does.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say, like, in a perfect world where there is, like, intervention care and there is post-care and there is care during the... Like, what would you say, like, the community needs the most to achieve
that? I feel like what the community needs the most, resources for housing. I feel like, you know, it's the survival of the fittest. Mm-hmm. And so if you're homeless, you're not thinking about trying to go to outpatient services, trying to get treatment. You're just trying to survive.
That's it.
So I feel like with the housing, once the housing is addressed, then, okay, we can start to dispatch to outpatient. You know, we can incorporate the services. Once you have, it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, until your lower level needs are met, you're not going to meet self-actualization. Mm-hmm.
You don't even think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why would you consider being clean and sober when I don't even have anywhere to live?
I did not consider getting clean and sober until I had somewhere to live. Yeah.
Why in the world would you? It's like regular real world stuff doesn't even come across your mind because you have to do this. Okay, now I have to figure out, because I've been homeless, so I know how this feels. Mm-hmm. When you wake up in the morning, you have to figure out first thing, how do I wash my face and brush my teeth?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not even how I wash my face and brush my teeth. Where do I even get the water from? Once I find someone that has running water, then I need a maybe a t-shirt, or maybe I need a washcloth or a rag. Where do I get that from? Mm-hmm. All right, and that's just your face, so I still got to be able to bathe. Okay, once I get that out of the way, then the next thing is, okay, I need to find something to eat. And then if you're a real true addict, you still got to figure out how you want to get high too. So you got all these things that you have on your, it's like a list of things that you carry on your shoulders and the weight of it that will completely make you oblivious to anything about trying to be productive and trying to grow and get sober, because you have to, that is a battle by itself.
And another thing that Jason can attest to, but he did, you know, I can honestly say he did the work. And that's the thing, when you're going into these programs, like where I work, like into these treatment programs, outpatient program, you got to be willing to want to do the work, to acknowledge the fact that you need to, you know, address whatever those needs are so that you can get to the next level. But a lot of barriers come when individuals, they've been homeless, they don't have birth certificate, they don't have social security card, they don't have driver license. And so, and they don't have any income, any money. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do you help these individuals that are homeless, that want help, that want housing, that want to be a better version of themselves, but they can't even find a starting point because they don't have a social security card?
Mm-hmm. Over to do ID. One, you need the other.
Yes, you have to.
I had a coworker who was like that. He was fresh off the street. Didn't have a birth certificate, didn't have a social security card, didn't have a license.
Yeah.
So my mom helped him get all these, gave him a job, and then helped him get all of these.
That's how it's done.
She gave him an opportunity. That's the biggest thing. What we need is the opportunity.
The opportunity.
And I'm speaking from the standpoint of a patient or a guest in a treatment center. This is the thing. When you come into these places, and then when you know that you have to, you want to grow, all you need is just that little opportunity. Mm-hmm. You need the door to be cracked this much. That's all you need. With me, I didn't even have any credentials as far as what I like, ID or license. We had to use, remember, I had to use a face sheet.
Yeah, face sheet.
I had to use a face sheet. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you the strange thing about the face sheet. When I took the face sheet to the Social Security place, the guy looked at the face sheet, looked at me, and he said, "This is not you." I was 144 pounds on that picture. He didn't even recognize me at all. So he still ended up giving it to me, but I had to go back one after that, remember, because I had to get the face sheet. It had to been notarized. It had to be signed by a doctor. It was this process over and over and over just to be able to get something that was going to be given to me free.
Yeah.
Just, and then, okay, now I've got this piece. So I put that to the side.
And I feel like that's where, with that, I think that the true meaning of a transitional house is just that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's what we was talking about last week, remember? Yep. I feel like individuals that are being discharged from a, a treatment program, like an outpatient program, trying to go to treatment, trying to go to the next step, or trying to return back to work, I feel like their transitional phase, the time that it takes for you to attain your identifications, like at least three to six months.
Yeah.
I feel like you should be in transition. And then within that transition process, you're learning life skills. You're learning job skills. You're learning social skills, resume mm-hmm. building, things like that that's mm-hmm. going to put you as a productive member of society yep. once you return back to work, you know, so that mm-hmm. you can. And not only that, like I said, it encourages. And, you know, if you don't have nothing, how can you be motivated?
You don't even want to.
You know what
be.
I'm saying? And then yeah. when you don't have any support, it's hard to find motivation. That's what I also, you know, try to, you know, I teach them, like, if you don't have no other support, it's important to be of your self-support.
Yes.
Pouring into yourself is so important. Pouring love into yourself. Mm-hmm. Caring, compassion, empathy, you know, giving, depositing those things into yourself, that allows you to be the person that you need to go to the next level. Mm-hmm. And so that you don't, even though if you have support, that's a plus.
Yes.
But if you don't have support, you won't be seeking that support from somebody else. You'll have that first layer of defense. I call it the first layer of defense mm-hmm. within you.
You remember this happened a lot too. People would get clean and sober, go through the program, and didn't have anywhere to go mm-hmm. after the 30, 45-ish days were over. Latazma, we would watch this. People would leave the program, go up the street, get a beer, get drunk, and come back in the program. People had stopped actually being addicted to drugs and started being addicted to programs and being addicted to rehabs because it was like the only way out. They could figure out how to do it. They couldn't maintain a regular life.
Yeah, or in some programs, you are required. I mean, like, you have to have...
You remember
that? You
have
to have, like, either high, like, yes. intoxicated or high yes. in order for the program to take you.
Yes.
So that's why I say it's a lot of
I remember
defects.
That.
Mm-hmm. You know, where like it's a lot of breakdown mm-hmm. in help that we need. And like I say, once those, like I said, that housing, that provides safety for these individuals. Then, like I say, we compile those resources, you know, for services. I think that it's just like Legos, like yeah. you're stacking. You know, like it helps.
It's a solution.
Yeah, it helps.
It's a solution. Yeah. It's the answer. It's mm-hmm. it's that one, what she's speaking of and what she's creating is a space where you completely you can start from ground zero. Mm-hmm. And this is a space that I can be able to start something. Because when you're in a space where you don't have anything, hope is so far away. You don't feel like, you don't even know how to go about starting how to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's you clock out on yourself. You become very withdrawn. You don't want to be sitting in a room listening to a therapist when you don't even got an ID, a license, a social mm-hmm. security card, because all you're thinking to yourself is, okay, what am I going to do in these 45 days? Mm-hmm. 45 yeah. days a move, just like that. So if these 45 days, I'm not doing anything. I'm not being proactive with these yeah. 45 days, at least by obtaining one piece of these material. It's no hope. So it's a repeat thing over and
it's
over.
A cycle.
So she's trying to start and open up a space where, okay, we see that you don't have. So the fact that you don't have, let's start here. Let's start here yeah. with ground zero, because it's a bunch of yous over here. It's a bunch of us that didn't have anything. People wouldn't even believe that when I started this back then in June of last year, that I would be here today. Because I did not have nothing. She will tell you that. I will repeat this on every podcast. I came to River Woods with one t-shirt, one pair of shoes, a pair of shorts, and no underwear.
And left with a wardrobe, buku, right. suitcases.
This
and
is true. This is true. But you remember, that's how
yeah.
I came.
Yeah.
I didn't have anything. Keep in mind, I didn't have anything as far as like material things to wear. Didn't have a job, but I also didn't have the credentials to get one.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm getting there now, but when I left, I had obtained every single thing except for a license. When I reached church recovery, that's when I'll never forget it. I had gotten my ID, birth certificate, social security card. I think that was it. And so I had paid the tickets that I needed to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? Because it was mm-hmm. in your classroom one day.
Yeah.
So I paid the tickets were paid that were holding me up from getting my license reinstated. So I had everything but $90 that I needed to have my license just reinstated. So when I got to church recovery, Joseph Hicks, who was here earlier today, which I thank God that he was here, he's the director of the program that I am now a part of an employee there. So thank God for that. He posted it on Facebook, and some random person, I don't even know who the guy was, messaged Joseph back and said, I'll pay the $90 for Jason's license. Paid the $90 2 days after the license was paid for. We went to across the bridge, and Marcus, I can't remember Marcus's last name, but his nickname is Lightbulb. He's at across the bridge. He donated a complete car to the program that I still drive to this day.
He told me he got a car. I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. Lord, let me know so I can get out the road. Right? I'm just so proud of him.
But it comes from a lot of networking and help and people that actually do care. Because mm-hmm. I would not be here today if it had not been for other people recognizing the fight in me, recognizing God in me, and me recognizing myself, saying, you know what, I can't just sit here and feel sorry for myself. Mm-hmm. I can't sit here and be stagnant. I have got to take advice and encouragement from these people that have these things and know the roadmaps to do, because all you got to really do is follow. Mm-hmm. That's all you really have to do. And
it's easier said than done, because like I say, a lot of people just not in that space or that place, that mental space, and just that physical place to even start the work, groundwork.
It wasn't easy either, because I still dealt with other things too.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've kind of created a bridge between the people who have so little that they don't mm-hmm. know where to begin to mm-hmm. get better, but have the desire to get better. Mm-hmm. And then you have the heart for those people to still see them as people and not a list of mm-hmm. symptoms, not just a junkie, not all these things mm-hmm. that, you know, may have stigma around it, but you see the person, and then you can bridge the gap and be like, okay, here's a wellness plan, and also mm-hmm. here's how you can get your license, here's how you can get your birth certificate, here's the actual useful tools mm-hmm. to be a functioning member of society, not just the let's unpack your trauma, but you know, you don't have anywhere to go when the session's over, and I think that's an important piece, because it's like you've identified, like, okay, this is cyclical. But where did the cycle start? Mm-hmm. And it maybe it started when they was kids, but as an adult, it continues at that spot of, okay, you don't have somewhere to go. Yep. That's where the problem is. How can we solve this? Mm-hmm. And that's crucial.
It is. Because
it has to, cycles have to stop somewhere.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're actively working toward figuring out how to create a landing platform.
And she's building a foundation. Yeah, that's what it really is. If you really want to call it for what it needs to be called, it's a foundation, because everything has to be built from the principles and what she's mm-hmm. adding to your life then. Because you can't get all of that mm-hmm. without getting this first.
Right.
So, it's essential. You have got, especially if you're an adult and you want to continue to be sober and live sober and get it, jump out in front of and be in control of your mental illness. Mm-hmm. You need these things.
Yeah.
And so when you don't, when you're walking around this earth feeling sorry for yourself, now that you have no need for the excuse now, you do have spaces and places where people are actually helping you from ground zero. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need. And it needs to be implemented into every single sober living program, treatment centers. Everyone needs this in those places, because that's where it starts from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as we come in for a landing here, is there anything that we didn't get a chance to touch on that you wanted to bring up, or some last words of encouragement to anyone who might be struggling out there?
My words of encouragement is just, like I said, just pour into yourself as much as you can. Find ways to love yourself. You know, once you're able to find that space and that place to start loving on yourself, you begin to nurture yourself. Then you begin to start whatever the next level that is needed for you. But it definitely has to start there. And just if you have an addiction, you know, history of addiction, or currently struggling with addiction, definitely just look a little deeper. Sometimes, like I said, I always talk about, I talk about that suitcase all the time. Mm-hmm. And just going back, we talked about this the other day, just going back to a place where you felt where your hobby, where the hobby turned into a habit, like a pattern. Just think about where you were, the things that you had experienced that led you to that point where you felt like you need to lean on that. And so just, I know support is limited, and it's kind of hard to get, but if you need, you know, you feel like you need help, please reach out, you know. And just like I said, just continue to love on yourself and just give yourself grace, because sometimes, you know, you can't get it right the first time. But as long as you continue to push forward and have an open mindset, that growth mindset, it's going to lead you to where you need to be. And I want to thank you guys for giving me an opportunity to experience my first podcast experience. So
you did great.
You did wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much
for joining us.
Yes.
And to the viewers and the audience, I 10-13 myself, right? So if you do want to see this beautiful lady, you decide to 10-13 yourself. I'm just playing. But she is at Riverwoods, and she's helping, saving lives every day.
Doing my best.
Thank you for this lady coming here and just being a part of my life, and we appreciate you.
Thank you, guys. You guys are doing a wonderful job. This is an awesome opportunity, an awesome platform that you guys have. So I just, like I say, I just thank you so much for allowing me to be here.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you to our donors and supporters who make this show possible. Mm-hmm. You can catch this episode and all the others on the Most High Media app, along with all of our other documentaries and productions. If there's a topic you'd like to see discussed on the show, please make sure to leave a comment wherever you're watching or listening. And this has been another episode of the Most High Show.
Yay.
Yay.
That was some good stuff, ladies.